In insects, we have the I. flavus viruses that include things like a flattery disease in silk moths. And in honeybees, we have many different viruses that fit in this: deformed wing virus, Sacbrood virus, Varroa destructor virus, Cucuca virus, and slow bee paralysis virus. And we have another group down below here called the Dicistra viruses. It's basically where we've taken the virus and switched it around into different parts. Here we have the known bee viruses: the cashmere bee virus, black and queen seal virus, and acute bee paralysis virus, Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. These viruses are very simple. They don't have anything in there that we know is involved in immunosuppression or other effects on the bees, but we haven't yet looked at those closely enough. In our lab, we know that they can infect the hemocytes of the bees and may have an impact on immune function at some point. We have shown, and others have shown as well, that when the bee is parasitized by Varroa and knocked out the immune system, that these bee viruses amplify in the colony, increase in prevalence and titer within the bees. So we began to look at these viruses and look at sequences, and what we looked at in the Dicistra viruses is here's this one little piece shown in red here that's between the two different polyproteins. And this is called the intergenic region. And so we sequenced bees that came out of these different colonies, out of individual operations. And so shown on here is a phylogenetic tree showing at the top acute bee paralysis virus, in the middle cashmere bee virus, at the bottom Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. And what we found was that the bees that we had in the United States, the Israeli acute bee paralysis virus, was very distinct from cashmere bee virus. And if you look at the cashmere bee virus here, we see that we have very similar viruses within these different colonies that came from primarily one operation. And if we look at within different colonies, that's what these numbers are over here, we have very low variation. Interestingly, when we look down here at Israeli acute bee paralysis virus, we find that we have much more sequence diversity and that there's variation within each of the colonies, suggesting that there might be multiple strains there. We also found that the Australian bees and their viruses lump right in with our American bees here using this. And we also found the Israeli sample here. And so we suggested that Israeli acute bee paralysis virus, when we went through all these sequences, that it was highly associated with CCD, that we look at 96.1% of the colonies and could predict that it was associated, that it had a 96.1 predictive value of CCD as opposed to these other three pathogens here. That if we have all four pathogens present in the colony, we can predict 100% that colony will have CCD. So, what we wanted to know is if IPV was found in other countries, is associated with loss, how long it's been in the United States, how many different strains do we have of IAPV in the U.S. and worldwide? And then lastly, is IAPV just a really good marker for CCD, or is it the actual potential cause? And that's where we're at right now. And if you're interested, I can tell you more about what we're doing on this, that both Jeff Pettis and myself, we're initiating studies to begin to address this last part here. And funding sources, we need to give major credit to the NIH awards to Ian Lipkin for the Northeast Biodefense, National Honey Board, Pennsylvania Chart Ag, and USDA through Jeff. And then we've begun pathogenicity studies here. And then lastly, I'd like to announce that that part of the public attention here has allowed out of the blue Haagen-Dazs to step forward and has made major gifts to both UC Davis and Penn State towards sustainable pollination. And so they're funding us at the both institutions to do things in research, outreach, and in training to help with this. And in February, you'll begin to see this little logo here show up on their ice cream, along with message about what importance bees play in American agriculture. So all their products that have fruit and that's directly dependent on bee pollination will have this symbol on there. And part of that money from the products will come back to support their gifts to Penn State and UC Davis. Part of the gift to Penn State will go towards web-based delivery of the information that we're generating from the entire colony collapse disorder working group. And hopefully we we hope that this attention will benefit entomology as a whole and not just the two institutions here. And unfortunately, the convention center or whoever wanted a lot of money, otherwise Häagen-Dazs would have treated us to their new flavor vanilla honeybee that will be showing up at today's symposium. So with that, I'd like to thank you for coming, and we'll have a break here, and we'll come back and we'll start the last part. 10-minute break here. Thanks.
Loading, let me tell you that in light of some recent developments for my last field season, I have changed the title of my talk. I'm very excited to be presenting to you today the first evidence for referential communication in a stingless bee species. Now, this study was performed on Barrow, Colorado Island in the Panama Canal. This is an excellent field site with a large number of endemic stingless bee species. Now, the species we chose to work with was Melipona panamica. Now, panamica is an average-sized stingless bee that forms colonies of between 500 and 800 individuals. And this is a very special species in that there's strong evidence for a dance and vibration-based communication system for height and distance information. When an experienced panamica forager returns to the nest, they perform a stereotyped set of motions that are accompanied by sound pulses. And these sound pulses have been shown to correlate very strongly with height and distance information. This makes this group an ideal candidate for finding referential communication. Now, in order for a communication system to be considered referential, it must fulfill two different criteria. The first is that the information in the signal must be encoded in such a way that the receiver has to transform or decode the signal to understand the information. Now, I'm presenting to you today in English, and since it's a language we share, you can understand me. However, were someone to come into the room who didn't speak English, they wouldn't be able to transform my words into understandable information because they've been encoded in a specific language. Now, the second criterion is that these signals must be context independent. Now, this is a little bit tricky. In order for a signal to be context independent, the receiver must be able to gather information from the signal in the absence of the environmental cues that the signal is actually referring to. So, for example, if a person walks into a movie theater and says that the building is on fire, people will get up and proceed towards the exits, even if they can't smell smoke and they can't see the flames. That's because the human language is context independent. You don't need the associated environmental stimuli to understand the information being provided to you. Now, the honeybee waggle dance is an ideal case for studying referential communication. It's a perfect example. Information about a resource is encoded in the different motions the forager makes when she returns to the nest. And the dance is actually performed inside the dark enclosed space of the nest, which is completely devoid of the environmental signals that the forager is communicating about. Now, how do you test for referential communication? Well, in the bee literature, it's been proposed that you can use manipulation or misdirection experiments. Now, in these experiments, you provide a forager with some exaggerated piece of information. You then see if that exaggerated information is communicated to recruits, who then demonstrate an exaggerated behavior. Now, most often, the exaggerated information you provide is about the distance the bee has traveled. Now, panamica, along with honeybees and other bee species, use a system called optic flow for distance measurement. This is where an individual measures the distance they've traveled by integrating the rate of angular image motion across their retina. They're basically seeing how fast contours are passing over their eyes. Now, the speed of image motion is very strongly correlated to how far away a contour is from your retina. Things that are close to your eye move much faster and farther than things that are farther away. Now, because of this, you can manipulate the distance a bee thinks it has traveled by inducing them to forage in a tight, confined environment, such as one of these patterned wooden tunnels. Now, a forager who has foraged inside the tunnel experiences a distance measurement that's much, much longer than the actual absolute distance they've traveled. Now, if that bee species is using referential communication, you should see that exaggerated distance measurement communicated to recruits who will then go and forage at a much farther distance than the distance inside the tunnel that was traveled by the original forager. Now, in our experiment, we conducted the study on the north and south balcony of the laboratory buildings on BCI. The nesting box was always present at the extreme north end of the north balcony. A subset of foragers between 20 and 30 were trained to forage inside one of those tunnels that I showed you in the previous slide. The feeder was placed at the far end of the tunnel at an absolute distance of 5 meters from the nesting box. We then set out a series of paired feeders to see where the recruits would go. In our first experiment, we just in general wanted to see if recruits were being sent to a distance that was close to the tunnel where the actual feeder was, or to a distance that was much further away. We placed a near-distance feeder at 6 meters, just 1 meter beyond the end of the tunnel, and another feeder at a medium distance of 60 meters away from the tunnel. In our second experiment, we wanted to see if recruits actually were being sent too far, just how far were they actually going? In this case, we paired our medium